Succession number 27083 reel 9.
So, Sir Henry, you leave the sardonyx after a mere 3 months. Just before we leave the sardonyx, a tiny sort of technical point which seems to confuse me slightly. Why, I understand in rough sea how the sea can come in, but how does the wardroom get 3 inches of water on the floor?
Oh, it just came down the hatch.
Oh, it comes down the hatch?
Yeah.
And you can't close the hatch?
I think if you did close the hatch, it wouldn't have made all that much difference, would it? Because that the door or the hatch wasn't particularly watertight.
Right.
And there it was. Yeah.
So it's extremely unpleasant living conditions for the officers.
I only mentioned this because everything was bad and was wrong and so forth, and yet she was a very happy ship.
Yes.
In spite of it all.
Yes.
Right. Well then, and the 3 months, of course, was the sort of statutory time for a midshipman to do in small ships. I was then appointed to the Anson, which was a brand new battleship of the King George V class, same as the Prince of Wales. And I joined her in Scarpa Flow in the spring of 42. I only had 2 months there, and then that would have been the end of my midshipman's time. And the reason I was sent there was that prior to that, and virtually the whole of my time in Mauritius, for example, you were, so to speak, part complement. You were, you kept watch as part of the armament, which you were required to do, and you filled a complement billet and that sort of thing. And so there had been very little time for additional navigation training and schoolwork generally, and so forth.
Schoolwork being naval instruction.
Yes, absolutely. And there was an instructor officer carried on board. And there were certain things that you got examined in at the end of your midshipman's time, which were theoretical. For instance, you had to be capable of producing, of drawing, the entire midship section of a battleship, which was very complicated. An utter waste of time, frankly. And what it taught you, I don't know. Answer not much, and that's all gone for a ball of chalk now. But these things you could only mug up by concentrated swatting and so forth. And so I was sent to Anson together with other colleagues. In fact, I think it was all the Mauritius gunroom, or the midshipman at any rate. And we had 2 months on board, and we didn't take part in the ship's activities at all, really. We just we slept and we worked in the so-called schoolroom right aft, which was bad when the ship was at sea because of the vibration and thumping and so forth. And we had no duties, and we had 2 months swatting, and that was it. The captain was a man called, charming man called Arthur Kenahan, who later became an admiral. And the commander was a man called Joe Colville, who had been a house officer at Dartmouth before the war. And I can well remember, he wasn't my house officer. And I suppose this would have been during my first term at Dartmouth, so I was very young and green. And annually in the summer they had a regatta. And in those days, wives of house officers were not allowed anywhere near the college. There were no marriage courses or anything of that sort. But for the regatta, they were let in, and so on. And Joe Colville's house and we were pulling whalers or gigs or whatever. And his house wasn't doing terribly well. And he stood up on top of the roof of the bathing stage down there, surrounded by wives, including the captain's wife, etc. And at the top of his not inconsiderable voice, he really blew his top at his crew, and he shouted out, "Pull, you buggers, pull!" And that was it. And he was the commander of Anson. The gunnery officer, who we shall meet again later in another capacity, was a man called J.Y. Thompson. Very nice, very quiet, clever. And as I say, I could go on. They had a splendid ex-lower deck commissioned bosun called O'Brien, who really was, he was a sort of master of the upper deck, and very effective too, a very nice man. And I've really nothing else to say about Anson, and I'm merely mentioning her as a tick in the box. It so happened that I had some connection with all ships of that class, one way or another. Anson was the first one that I was connected with. I had been appointed to Prince of Wales. Father had been the captain of the Prince of Wales. I'm just coming on to the King George V, where I took my midshipman's free board. After I had done subs courses, I went, and this will all come out later, I went as sub of the gunman to Duke of York. And years later, my father-in-law, though he wasn't then, was the captain of the Howard. So there was a fairly close connection with all those ships. And I turn now to my fleet board. Though I was still in Anson, the board was held in Scarpa Flow in the King George V. The president was the captain of the ship, one Philip Mack, who very sadly was killed a few months later in an air accident. Splendid man. And the sort of form that the board took, you had quite stretching exams, mainly oral, but not entirely, of which the ship's construction one, the midship section, I've already mentioned. The rest were either oral or practical. And they covered rigging, anchor work, rule of the road, organization, practical signals, ship construction I've mentioned, officer watch duties at sea and in harbor, and they were normally taken, the officer watch side, because this was really the key point, the ball point. They were normally taken by the president, and then we had practical examinations in boat work, under sail, under power, and under oars, and so on. For all this, and tacked on was what you've got for your journal and your sight book, navigation, it totaled up to 1,000 marks. And I got 916 and a first class certificate. More interesting, two aspects. First was the officer watch in harbour exam taken by the president, by Captain Mack, who was the sort of man that you took to immediately. A very nice man indeed. And his question was, your officer watch in harbour and it comes on to blow. What to do about it? And I went through all the usual things, and they informed the captain, informed the commander, You think to the safety of your boats. Have you got any livid men ashore? She said, the boats. Now, what are you going to do about them? And I said, well, if you can do so in time, you will hoist them. And he said, well, it's pretty dicey. I said, well, you send them inshore to get shelter until the storm has blown itself out. I said, they'll never make it to the shore. I mean, he's being deliberately difficult and so forth, because there was one particular solution that he wanted. So one was left really with a glimmering of the answer, which was somehow you had to hoist the boat, the last boat that was still down. And so you said, very glib sort of thing out of the cemetery manner, you spread oil to calm the surface of the water while you're hoisting. Oh yes, he said. How would you do that? And I said, well, where would you get the oil from anyway? And I said, well, you send down to the engineer's office, sir. Yes, he said, and okay, you got the oil. Well, how have you got it? What's it in? He said, a drum, sir. Well, how are you going to spread it to be effective when the boat comes under the crane? And all sorts of things that you hadn't really thought about. And you went stumbling on. I said, you punch holes in it with a marlin spike and you take it forward and you string it out over the lower boom. He said, well, that's not going to be much fun when it's blowing a gale, is it? I said, no, sir, but you've got to do it in order to get the boat up safely. And that wasn't what he wanted. I didn't get that one right. And what he wanted was to take it right forward to the seamen's heads, pour it down the seamen's head and pull the flushes. And that's what he wanted. That was that. And the other interesting one was the practical boat work. I went away in a whaler under sail with a rather elderly lieutenant of the sort that needed to shave about three times a day and had only done it once and not very well. Appeared to have no sense of humour whatsoever. And unlike Captain Mack, who you instantly took to and thought, you know, can't see enough of this chap, this was the reverse. And I took an instant dislike to him. And he played all the tricks on me, like boat's crew of five. And so one had his cap off, one had his chin stayed down, the others didn't. They were all doing something. Somebody had his arm trailing over his side, and they were all out to be sloppy and ill-disciplined and so forth. And this chap had his top button of his monkey jacket undone. And I got into the boat, and he said, right, take charge. I want you to do so and so. I forget what it was. And I said, right, sir, am I in charge of it? Yes, I told you, take charge. Right, I said. So I started off with the rig, on caps, down chin stays, all of you, and do your top button up, sir. And he didn't like it one little bit. Well, we got through. We had to pick somebody up as if it had been a man overboard and so forth. And we got round that all right. And there are basically two methods of bringing a boat under sail alongside a gangway. I think the generally approved method is to, if there's the ship and the gangway, you come in at an angle and then you gradually fine up and you're finally alongside. The interesting, if rather risky, method is to come in exactly at right angles but slightly above the gangway. And at the last minute, and you've got to get the timing right, you put the helm hard down and you end up pointing the same way as the ship, and you're alongside. Bang, just like that. if you make a cock, you've either no base or no gangrene. And I chose to do the latter. And this fellow was having kittens. But by the luck of the Lord, it worked. So that was that. Well, then I was made an acting sub-lieutenant, and off I went on subcourses, which in the main took you around the various establishments in the Portsmouth area. There were exceptions. Navigation and pilotage was done at Southwick Park, which is just outside, well, between Portsmouth and Cosham, which had been a private estate, because the navigation school in Portsmouth Town, Portsmouth Dockyard, had been bombed by then. And I managed to get some shooting there. I got in touch with a local agent and got permission to shoot pigeon. Well, that was a foot in the door. And the owner, who'd been kicked out of his stately home,
because the government required it.
Because the government required it, being commandeered. And he'd been a keen shot. And in fact, he'd always asked Cincy Portsmouth to shoot twice a season and that sort of thing. And then when Cincy turned around and commandeered his house, he never got asked again, somewhat understandably, and so forth. Anyway, I got a bit of shooting, which I'm bound to say I stretched a point and had one or two very entertaining pheasants as well as the pigeon, including one that I dropped on the keeper's doorstep, which wasn't very tactful. So. Signals were done at Lay Dean, again another lovely country house outside Portsmouth. Torpedo, Vernon had been bombed at the time, the Portsmouth Torpedo School, and they'd evacuated, and the sort of instructional block was at Rodine, the girls' school, which had been evacuated somewhere. But because there wasn't room to put up all the subs, the subs were, they slept only, in St. Dunstan's, which was that hideous building. After I pulled out of active, I became chairman of St. Dunstan's for 16 years, so I shall return now. In Rodine, the dormitories had been converted to lecture rooms and so forth, and by the electric light switch, by the door into each one, there was a delightful little notice saying, printed and framed and so forth, saying, "Ring for a mistress." But that, the effect had been disconnected, and so that didn't get you very far down the road. And equally in St. Dunstan's, at each floor level, the banisters had the appropriate number of studs on, representing the floor level. And so we thought, whoopee, you know, we can have an absolute blunder in Brighton Town and claw our way back to our pit, and there'd be no problem. But you couldn't have a blunder in Brighton Town in the spring of 1942, I'm afraid. So that was that.
Brighton had lost its reputation.
Well, the only entertaining bit in Brighton Town I experienced there, for the first and last time in my life, and several of us, about half a dozen of us, went to see, very much off the cuff, we went to see an all-in wrestling match. And we cut it very fine. I mean, we hadn't booked tickets or anything like that. And it was in some theatre, rather sleazy theatre, as I recall. And the only seats we could get were absolutely at the depths of the pit. And all around the ringside were really well, you might say, grossly overdressed women, dripping mink coats and that sort of thing, which was interesting. Of course, the war was on, so quite a lot of men absent and so forth. And we sat in the depths of the pit, our little clutch together. And we were surrounded by the less reputable women of the town. And I'd never seen either before or since an all-in wrestling match. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
Well, you haven't missed much. It's a complete put-up show. It's show, and it can't actually happen for real to the extent that it seems to do, because otherwise they kill each other, and that sort of thing. And, you know, for example, a chap would rush out of his corner and get within kicking distance of his opponent and give him a great boot to the balls or the stomach or whatever. And the chap would scream and fall flat on the floor. But then they'd pick themselves up and go back to their corners. If it had been for real, you know, he would have been into a wooden case. And there was one particular fight, and there were two huge men, absolute giants, and the referee was a Canadian, I recall, with cropped hair, tough little thug, bulging in muscle and that sort of thing, but he was the referee. And one of these guys was, I think one was an Italian. How that worked out in Britain in the middle of the war, I don't know. My memory is playing me false. But there'd been a lot of sort of monkeying about with these two giants. And one had got the other flat on his back on the canvas. And you know the business, in all in wrestling, you win when you have got your opponent's shoulders flat on the canvas. And you see the referee trying to slip his hand underneath to see if he can. And if he can't, guys won. And this chap was very nearly flat on the canvas. He was on his back. His legs were crossed. And the winning guy, singularly nasty bit of work, placed one foot on his opponent's crossed legs and leapt forward and was just sort of quietly plucking the hairs off his chest. And the crowd bawled. They thought this was super. And we weren't very enamored with this. And when the crowd was saying, and that sort of thing, we said, boo. And all these dreadful women packed on either side of us promptly rounded on us, so we shut up there. And the end of that run was that the chap eventually wriggled free, whereupon one or both got hold of the referee and banged his head against the other chap's head and tossed him out of the ring. So that was a pretty, not really part of my life history. Now, the only one I haven't mentioned was Gunray at Whale Island. And we had a splendid officer instructor who was a young captain of Marines called Pickering. Very smart, knew his gunray backwards. There was a very good spirit at Whale Island. I eventually became a specialist gunray officer. But there was a very good spirit, and it was basically work hard, play hard. And they played it accordingly. Throughout all those courses, I worked very hard. I was seldom in bed before 1 a.m. And it paid off, because if you've done your prep, you pass a good exam, and you've got a first-class certificate. And I got first-class certificates in all subjects. As a result of which, a rather reluctant Admiralty gave you £10 worth of books or instruments. So I asked for a telescope, and I was told it wasn't an instrument. And so it went on, and I eventually ended up with some ghastly thing. But amongst the courses were was a so-called gas course, which was sponsored by Whale Island, and they, curiously, because the others didn't, they gave you instruction on a Saturday morning. And a chum of mine, called Peter Bennett, and I decided that we'd manured the ground, and we'd more or less been told that you didn't have to attend a Saturday morning lecture. So we decided that on the Friday afternoon we'd go to London. And that was that. And we didn't tell anybody else at all. And our colleagues were a bit miffed when they found that the two of us were missing next day and so forth. We did this again later on. That was another matter.
May I just interrupt and ask you, how many other officers achieved marks of the level of 916 out of 1,000 of first-class certificates in all subjects? In other words, were you nearly on your own, or were there quite a few of you up there?
There weren't very many. It was, dare I say, it was quite a hot performance. But it was one for which I achieved it by sheer hard work, not by brilliance of intellect or anything. And it was worth it because you got additional seniority as a result.
Yes. That was my next question.
Yeah.
You got, was it, how much did you get?
I can't remember. I think you could gain something like 3 months, up to 3 months seniority. Instead of, out of a year or so. It was worth going for, I thought.
Yes.
Anyway, I went for it. I got it. Well, to get back to this weekend product, we'd booked and got tickets for Blythe Spirit, which was running in London at the time. What we had not done, rather foolishly, was to book ourselves in for the night. And in those days, of course, the theatre started at 1700, 5 o'clock in the evening. And we got to London, trains a bit late, so forth. We thought we had plenty of time. And I was very ignorant about London. The only time, very seldom, I'd been there. I'd stayed with my parents at, I've forgotten where, some pub down in Kensington. And so I told the driver, the taxi driver, to take us there. And of course they were full up. We went somewhere else and they were full up. And by this time we were beginning to run out of time. And I was fed up with this very unhelpful cabbie. And so I finally rounded on him and said, well, come on, you're supposed to know where hotels are. Where else is there? Because we're now getting pretty desperate for time. And this got under his skin, and he was knocked by my attitude. And he said, oh, those carriages just around the corner. I said, well, what the hell are you waiting for? Take us to carriages. Claridge's meant nothing to me whatsoever. Round to Claridge's we went. And we waded through the thick pile of carpet up to the reception desk. And there was a terrible young man with a sort of spit of a toothbrush moustache that it willowed in frightfully superior. And he said that they were full up. And there were we, of course, in uniform, dressed as sub-lieutenants. And at that point, I blew my top and said, you stand there, miserable, simpering bit of stuff, and here are we fighting the war for you and the likes of you, and even the uniform we stand up in, and I pulled out my ill-fitting monkey jacket, is borrowed because we've been shipwrecked. And he took a pace step back in his headroom, whatever it was we were in. And we dropped our bags and ran. We had a super show in Blythe Spirit. And then we had a bite of supper. And then we knew that the thing to do was to, but we neither of us ever done it, was to go off to a nightclub. And we summoned a taxi, and we said we wanted to go to a nightclub. And, two or three cabbies declined to take us. And they made sort of doubtful remarks like, oh, I know where you want to go, and that sort of thing. They all thought we were asking to be taken to a brothel, which we were not. Mm-hmm. We weren't quite sure what we were asking to be taken to, but still, that's another matter. And finally, we found a man that said that he knew a nightclub and he'd take us through. And we went. And this was a very doubtful place, and I've only once heard it mentioned in somebody else's book, and it was called the Slip-In. And I don't know, no respectful, you wouldn't have heard of it, no respectful person has ever heard of the Slip-In. I can't remember where it was, but it was somewhere in the heart of London. And it had a glass dance floor. And it wasn't all that late, but it was late enough. And we wanted a glass of grog. We were fairly reasonably...